Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. A very happy Thursday to you. If it's Thursday, if it's Friday morning where you are, good morning all over the East. And welcome. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we've got 2 hours. We're going to clear the mailbags. Every now and then, we do this internet open forum, and Jimmy answers all the questions that come through us through the various forums, written forums, that where people can send questions. So I won't be giving out the phone number. Well, actually, the truth is I probably will be giving out the phone number, but when I do, it'll be a mistake, and Sarah will give me the look, and I'll just sheepishly go on with the program. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy, Cy Kellett.
Thank you for being here with us for an internet open forum.
Always happy to do it.
We still have not exhausted the internet's ability to produce questions. We have not gotten to the end of the internet.
They used to have signs.
Yeah, that was,
it's like you've gotten to the end of the internet. You may now go outside and play.
Yeah, I actually never came to one of those, but I heard that people came to those. Mm-hmm. And it's a good reminder because you can get a little bit lost there in the internet world. Almost gave out the number. Sarah. Okay, thank you. Keep giving me the look. All right. We got a whole bunch of questions, Jimmy. But tomorrow is Friday, and that means a new Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. What's going to happen on the Mysterious World tomorrow?
We're going to be telling people about Operation Northwoods. Operation Northwoods was a plan that was developed in 1962 by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to help get us into a war with Cuba. And to help get us into a war with Cuba, the plan was to frame Cuba for aggressive actions against the United States and other countries. And as part of this, they would be conducting potentially a terrorist attacks on American soil and maybe killing people.
This is so outrageous, but this is one of those things where it's hidden away until the files are opened decades later, right?
So you just, Yeah, the file on Operation Northwoods was declassified in the 1990s, and so this is real. This is an actual plan the Joint Chiefs proposed that President John F. Kennedy said no to.
Oh, I'm so glad there's somebody who was the no person who's like, no, we're not doing that. That's you need that. I'm glad that there's a hero to the story, but it's frightening to think that people thought, this seems like a reasonable plan. People who were in positions of authority thought, this seems like a reasonable plan. We'll just frame Cuba for some murders.
Well, they felt under a deadline because Cuba had not yet fallen into the Soviet orbit. And it was in the process of doing so. And they said, this is going to be much harder to deal with if we let Cuba become a Soviet bloc nation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so we need to take action before that happens because they could do things like stage nuclear missiles there, which they then did later in the same year. So there was some urgency to the situation, but I'm glad we didn't have U.S.-sponsored false flag terrorist attacks on American soil in 1962.
Yeah, right. It seems to me, though, that we have this just war theory. And a lot of times when you hear people talk about war, the way they talk about it actually draws on classical Catholic just war theory. But it does seem to me that there's been this long debate, and we still don't have an answer to it. Maybe you have a moral answer to it about what is one country's obligation when another country, is essentially in a state of slavery to tyrants who are cruel and even murderous tyrants like the Castros have been in Cuba? Like, does just war theory account for that?
I think it does in principle, or at least an extension of it can, because you have the same thing happening on a smaller scale. I mean, just war is essentially a magnification of the self-defense principle that applies to each of us as individuals, where if someone attacks you and there's no way to save yourself or your family other than using lethal force, it's moral to use lethal force. And the same thing applies when you scale it up to nations. Well, so let's go back to the small scale. Suppose there was a group of people that were human trafficking and had enslaved some people and were abusing them and gravely violating their rights. Well, law enforcement could come in that situation and break up the human trafficking ring. And so in principle, the same thing could happen on the nation state scale, but there would be problems about exactly how do you adjudicate that in the international environment. But in principle, it could work.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, I do think often there is a good impulse under some of the, the war thing, you really want to, I think there's a general consensus against war, and I don't want to be on the wrong side of that, but like some governments really are evil and they really do need, that needs to be addressed. Like it was a great day when Idi Amin left Uganda. That was a great day. So, yeah. And people need
to be. On the other hand, some of the bad governments also have nuclear weapons, which makes the situation much more complex.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And when you, that's right. It's very complex. Not an easy one. I wish we would talk more, though. I'm glad we had this conversation because I do think Catholics need to talk more about just war theory because it's really very enlightening that there's this whole body of thought that some great people like St. Augustine, for example, have given us to help us think through these difficult problems. I'm ready to go to questions. You ready to go to questions?
Oh, sure.
All right. Well, I'm not going to the phones. I'm just going to read what Gerardo said. Here's Gerardo's question. Thank you for the question, Gerardo. My question is in regard to the need of the body during the second coming. Why do we require our body then? Will we be living on earth? Will our resurrected bodies ascend to heaven? If we ascend to heaven, then why do we need a body? What is the purpose of a resurrected body in heaven?
So it's very common for people to talk about humans going to heaven when they die. And it's easy for people to think of that as a permanent state, that like our final destiny is in heaven rather than on the earth. But that's not actually what the Bible teaches or what the church teaches. Going to heaven, so to speak, is a purely temporary thing that happens between death and resurrection. Now, the reason we need our body is because God designed us not to be simply spiritual beings. He also designed us to be physical beings. So we're a combination of the two. In order to be a complete human being, you need both a body and a soul. And so we're different than the angels. Angels are purely spiritual. They don't have bodies. They're not designed to have bodies, but humans are. And so the human destiny is to be like what God designed us to be an embodied spirit. And so that's why we need our bodies back eventually and why God will ultimately give us our bodies back, because that's the way he designed human nature, to include both things. Now, in terms of where we'll be after we get our bodies back, Scripture presents us as living on what's called the new earth. The new earth appears to be a renovated, improved, upgraded version of this earth. So at some point at the second coming, God will upgrade the world. It will be a much better place. And the book of Revelation, which gives us a glimpse, at least hints at what the new earth is going to be like, it indicates will be in full spiritual union with God. The heavenly city, New Jerusalem, descends out of heaven and lands on earth. And this is not meant to be taken literally, but it's a sign of the union spiritually between heaven and earth. So we won't have the kind of spiritual separation from God that we have now. Instead, we'll be living lives on the new earth, in our bodies doing stuff, but also in full spiritual union with God.
That's the good news, Gerardo. Thank you very, very much for the question. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an internet open forum today, clearing the mailbags out. And so we just sit back, relax, and enjoy the questions and the answers from Jimmy Akin. The 20 Answers Summer Reading Challenge continues, and we started it early. It's now been explained to me. It's a summer reading challenge in that the challenge is to read all 44 books in the 20 Answers series by the end of summer. And so you get 70% off the set right now. 44 books in our 20 Answers series, 20 answers on all kinds of topics related to the Catholic faith. And you can get it at 70% off at shop.catholic.com.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back. Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Hey, it's Wednesday, and that means a new episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, has dropped. You can check it out at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Catholic Answers Focus, the world's premier podcast on Catholic apologetics, now available every Wednesday at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And we've got a whole bunch of questions from the internet for Jimmy. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and has written a whole bunch of books, including his most recent book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. You can find all of Jimmy's books over at shop.catholic.com. Well, I don't even know if I'm telling the truth. Are all of your books over there, or do you write books that go other places?
I have a few things other places, too.
Oh, yeah. All right. Let's give you Antonella's question. Is it possible to trace an individual bishop today back to one of the 12? In an era of ancestry passion, it would be great to be able to find our Catholic ancestry. Thank you, and God bless you, Antonella. Well, God bless you too, Antonella.
So we do know that the bishops that are ordained today do have lines of ordination that stretch back to the original apostles. That's not in doubt. That's something that we can show a variety of ways. But it gets a little harder if you're trying to trace a particular bishop's lineage all the way back to the apostles, because not every record from the past has survived. In fact, in various places, the records only go back so far. This is because, for example, in Europe, the climate is wet. And as a result, lots of records that are, say, kept on parchment or papyrus would decay over time. They'd either become illegible, or they'd rot, or they might be destroyed in fire or lost in war or things like that. And so that's why from Europe, we don't tend to have records that go back beyond a certain point. That's one of the reasons that when you do find ancient papyrus documents and so forth, they're often in dry climates like in Egypt. Mm-hmm. Or down near the Dead Sea, where we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, because that dryness enables the records to survive for much longer. But with the Catholic bishops in Europe, for example, we just don't have records past a certain point because they've been destroyed or lost. We do have records that go back centuries, though, and it is possible to trace the lineage of particular bishops going back in time. There's a website, actually. I believe it's catholic-hierarchy.org, where you can look up a bishop. And it tries to cover all the bishops in the world today. But you look up a given Catholic bishop, and you can trace his ordination lineage back multiple centuries. And you can see exactly who ordained who and on what date. And it's fascinating to look at that. Beyond the document horizon, we could call it, we know that there were these lineages going even further back. And we can conjecturally reconstruct what they would have been. You know, if a bishop is in Paris, let's say, he would have been ordained by a previous bishop of Paris in all likelihood, or by other bishops in that area. so we could get a sense of who likely ordained who even before the advent of documents, but that involves more conjectural work. What we can say is that the lineages are secure because one of the principles that goes way back in church history is having multiple bishops consecrate a new one. The goal is like at least three. And so that way, even if there was a problem with one of the bishops doing the consecration, the other bishops would make sure that the new consecration was valid. So this is a form of what's known as error correction. You know, if you if you have files that you're trying to transmit, let's say over the internet, well, there's a possibility a given file might become corrupted. So you have error protection, error correction methods to adjust for that and make sure that the file goes through properly. The same thing applies with ordinations. Even though a single bishop might, for one reason or another, not be doing an ordination or a consecration validly, the other bishops involved will be. So you have multiple redundancies as an error correction feature to ensure the proper transmission of holy orders.
So that's why the three bishops at an ordination of a bishop. That's interesting. Because there's always one guy who's like the main consecrator, but then you have the other lay their the other two lay their hands just to we're not going to play around with this apostolic succession thing.
Right, it's a serious thing.
Hey, well, thank you very much, Antonella, for the blessings and for the question. Question next for Jimmy Aiken from Lawton. I was doing some research and I came across questions about the Exodus. One, people, do you want me to give them to you all at once, Jimmy?
No, there are several here, and these are essentially objections that he's run across to the idea of the historical Exodus in the Bible.
Okay,
so why don't we take them one at a time?
Okay, people argue Canaan was occupied by Egyptians. Wouldn't that have invalidated the story?
No, so the Egyptian Empire went through a number of different phases, and the phase during which the Exodus occurred is a period known as the New Kingdom. The New Kingdom was from, it started about 1550 BC. Before that, there was a more chaotic time called the Second Intermediate Period when Egypt had basically fallen apart and it was not a single united government and you had different people ruling in different parts of it. But then, and so obviously during a chaotic period, like an intermediate period, like the second intermediate period, Egypt is not united. It's in a chaotic state. And so it's not going to be able to project power and occupy other locations. Then the Egyptians at the end of the second intermediate period get their act together. They reunite the country. And we have three dynasties, the 18th, 19th, and 20th, that rule. But they go through ups and downs too. The 18th dynasty had an expansionist period where they did occupy Canaan to some degree. They didn't fully occupy it. It wasn't totally under their control, but they would go over there and beat up the Canaanite kings and exact tribute from them and then haul the tribute back to Egypt. That was one of your key jobs if you were Pharaoh. It was to go beat up other people and take their stuff. And so the 18th century pharaohs were fairly successful at doing that. But then we get into the 19th dynasty. And the 19th dynasty had one of the greatest pharaohs of all time. His name was Ramesses II. And he reigned for a very, very long period of time in the 1200s BC, multiple decades. And he's the pharaoh that most scholars think the Exodus occurred under. Well, the thing is, when the Egyptians had a pharaoh who reigned for a very long time, it usually didn't go that well for them because as Pharaoh gets older, he's not as physically able to go beat people up and take their stuff. And so he's going to be getting weaker over time. Now, they had a special ceremony to try to help the pharaoh retain his youth. It was called the Hebsed Festival, and it would occur like on the 30th anniversary of Pharaoh's reign and then periodically thereafter. And the pharaoh would do things to magically rejuvenate himself, like run a race course and wrestle with younger men and things like that. And this was supposed to restore the pharaoh's vitality, but like a lot of folk magic remedies, didn't really work. And so as a result, when you had a pharaoh that reigned for a really long time, the empire tended to lose its ability to project force into other territories. And so it looks like what happened is as Ramesses II aged, he got weaker, as you would expect, and the Israelites were able to escape and leave and occupy part of, start moving in to the promised land, where the Egyptians were now having trouble projecting force. And we see some evidence for that in the reign of Ramesses II's son, Merneptah. Because Merneptah, he's a younger guy now, at least somewhat younger than his father. And when he comes to the throne, he does start to try to go back over into Canaan and start taking the stuff. And he had some military victories there that he recorded on a monument known as the Merneptah Stela. And he mentions Israel as being there at that point. But one of the interesting things about the Egyptian writing system is they have these little symbols that they'll put after a word to tell you what kind of class of objects it goes into. These are called classifiers. They're also sometimes called determinatives. And like, for example, if you have the most famous one is the cartouche. You know, it's that oval that you see around the names of pharaohs.
Oh, yeah.
That's a determinative. It tells you that it's a pharaoh here. And what that circle's supposed to do is a magic circle that protects the pharaoh by surrounding him magically. And there are other determinatives too. My favorite is called the evil bird, and it's a little bitty bird. It looks kind of like a sparrow. And when it's put after a word in Egyptian, it indicates that whatever the word refers to is bad, weak, evil, or annoying.
Ah.
And but there's also a sign for like city or country. And those will get put after people who have cities and countries. But when it comes to the reference to Israel on the Merneptah Stela, it uses a different classifier, a different determinative that signifies a people, but not one that has a city yet or a country yet. And so it looks like he may have had military engagement with the Israelites when they were still semi-nomadic before they had fully settled in the land. So that's additional evidence pointing to an exodus during the reign of Ramesses II.
All right. Then a second objection from our, let me just make sure, Lawton, from our listener Lawton. There are no artifacts from their 40-year journey, the Israelites' 40-year journey.
Well, we have the Merneptah Stela. That might have been written during the 40-year journey. But also think about it. I mean, they're crossing the desert in the Sinai Peninsula. What are you going to find that you're going to be able to identify as theirs? Now, number one, the Sinai Peninsula has not been excavated. It is a big desert wasteland, and not much of it has been excavated. So there could be all kinds of artifacts there that we have no clue about. But second, you got to say, well, okay, what would we find that could survive from that period? Let's say someone lost a sandal. Well, how likely is it that a sandal is going to survive for 3,200 years, you know, exposed to the weather? It could easily be destroyed, or someone lost a wooden bowl or a clay pot. Well, it's likely to get smashed or otherwise destroyed. And then even if it survived the ages, how would you know this is an Israelite artifact? How, and because they'd just been living in Egypt, a lot of their artifacts would look Egyptian. You know, they'd have Egyptian pottery styles and things. So how would you even know whose artifact this was? So we really wouldn't expect to find artifacts that are identifiable and have survived the ages in the currently unexcavated Sinai Peninsula.
All right. A third objection then. The Egyptians were not big on slaves.
This is flat wrong. The Egyptians were very big on slaves. That was one of the things that was part of Pharaoh's job. If his job is to go beat people up and take their stuff, that included taking slaves. And so pharaohs would do things like go into other lands and take a bunch of captive slaves and bring them back to Egypt. And we have evidence of something like that happening at the end of the second intermediate period. Now, the second intermediate period, remember, was when Egypt had fallen apart. And in the north, there was a group of rulers who were known as the Hyksos. And the Hyksos were not native Egyptians. They were Canaanites. They were Semites that had come in from elsewhere and taken over northern Egypt. And the evidence that we have suggests that Joseph became the vizier of one of the Hyksos pharaohs. And then when the new kingdom begins and the Egyptians get their act together again, they conquer the Hyksos and drive the rulers out of Egypt and enslave the other people. And that's likely how the Israelites became slaves of the Egyptians, because they were allied with the hated Hyksos that the Egyptians kicked out and then conquered their servants.
We're working with Jimmy through objections to the biblical account of the Exodus. These questions come from Lawton, and I am enjoying this. So we are just going to work our way through the rest of Lawton's objections that he read about to the Exodus. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. It's an open forum, both hours today, but it's an internet open forum. All of these questions have come to us via the internet. Right back after this. Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
That Sarah is all right. A little bit of groovy music for Jimmy Akin for an internet open forum. For an internet open forum, we got the groovy music. Thank you, Sarah. Jimmy, this is fascinating to me. So I want to continue with Lawton's series of questions and their objections. Sure. to the Exodus, to the biblical account of how the Hebrew people left Egypt. And we worked our way through several of the objections. Egyptians were not big on slaves, and you had just said, yeah, they were. So mm-hmm. Was there anything else you wanted to add to that, or shall we move on?
Not on that point.
Okay. All right. So the next objection is military forts would have littered the path that they took. I assume this would mean, okay, so that they would have been just taken slaves again by these military forts.
That's the idea. Now, it's true that if you go along the northern route from where the Israelites were, and if you think about the shape of the Mediterranean Sea and Egypt, we know that the Israelites were living in the northern part of Egypt where the Nile fans out and becomes this very fertile area known as the Nile Delta. That's where they were living. And so they're already very close to the Mediterranean Sea. And there were a string of forts that the Egyptians had along that road that runs next to the border of the Mediterranean Sea heading towards Canaan. And so so there are a few things to note here. The first one is, and this is what's called the northern route to get there. But you don't have to go by the northern route. You can also, you don't have to hug the Mediterranean Sea as you're making your way there, because you can go further south via a southern route in the Sinai Peninsula and also get there. Well, it so happens that in Exodus, the children of Israel are told, don't go by the northern route, which is where the forts are. And they're specifically told, don't go by the northern route, lest they see war and turn back. So that would suggest that, okay, lest they encounter military resistance at those forts and get discouraged and come back. So there's one solution. Another solution is that if the Israelites, if the Egyptians have just been hit with a number of plagues and were later in the reign of Ramesses II, when the their ability to project power is diminishing, those forts may be understaffed. And so if you have a few dozen guys at a fort, or even a few hundred, and thousands of Israelites are coming by, the fort may not make a big difference.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, because even 200 guys with, you know, bows and arrows and swords and chariots is not going to be a match for 20,000 Israelites. And so, you know, there's not as much to fear there as you might think. So there are multiple possible solutions to this. And in fact, we have some evidence that they, I mean, they spent a lot of time wandering in the Sinai Peninsula, but those forts were only in the northern part. They weren't all through the peninsula.
Okay. So the next objection, the Exodus story is, I guess what he's saying, it reflects the stories of Akhenaten and Sargon. So I assume there's an earlier story that sounds like this might be a copy of it. Is that what he's saying?
Yeah. So we should talk about who these guys are. So Akhenaten was famous as the heretic pharaoh of Egypt. He initially believed in all of the Egyptian gods, just, you know, like he was raised to. But then he became obsessed with one particular god known as the Aten. Aten was a solar deity that is symbolized by the disk of the sun. He's different than other solar deities like Amun-Ra and so forth. So he became obsessed with the sun disk, with the Aten, and he initially mandated that, okay, everybody's going to worship the Aten now. And then he went further and he said, oh, and we're not going to worship any of the other gods anymore. And we're going to start chipping their names off of the temples and things like that. And he set up his own capital in the desert at a place called Amarna. And he lived this kind of hippie lifestyle there, where he was into the Aten and leading his religious ceremonies, but not into doing his job of conquering other people and taking their stuff.
This is a theme. I see this theme. That's what you got to do if you're Pharaoh.
Yeah, they're like the Goa'uld on Stargate.
Okay.
And so after he died, his son, Tutankhaten, restored the original religion and became known as Tutankhamun. So he changed the Aten in his name back to a traditional different god, Amun. And so he's King Tut.
Funky Tut.
And yeah. Now, because born in Arizona, moved to Babylonia.
Yeah, I know his background. Yeah.
Yeah. So because Akhenaten, his father, was either a monotheist or something close to being a monotheist, people have said, oh, that may have some relationship with Moses being a monotheist or something like a monotheist. Okay. And in fact, you know, like Sigmund Freud even wrote a book about this on Moses and monotheism and talked about Akhenaten, and other people have talked about it too. Here's the deal. So what? Even if Akhenaten was a full monotheist, how does that stop God from revealing himself to Moses? Or even if you didn't believe in God, if one guy has the idea of monotheism, well, all humans have brains. Someone else could come up with the same idea.
Yeah.
So merely because you got a couple of monotheists in this general time period doesn't mean that one is dependent on the other. In fact, depending on the timing, if you wanted to argue it, I mean, if you wanted to say that Moses was before Akhenaten, you could say, well, maybe Akhenaten got the idea from Moses, though actually the chronology tends to point in the other direction. Then we have Sargon. So Sargon was a king in a completely different culture. Sargon was a king in Mesopotamia, which is, so you think, like modern Iraq.
Yeah.
That's where he was. And the connection to Sargon is that there is a legend that when Sargon was a baby, he got put in a basket and floated on a river.
Okay.
Okay. Now, that sounds like what happened to Moses.
Yes.
Okay. So, this may, how do we explain this? Well, it could be coincidence. It also could have been a custom, you know, like we have a custom or have until recently in our own culture of putting babies in baskets and leaving them on doorsteps if you can't take care of them. And I mean, you see that all the time in like 19th century fiction. People find a baby on their doorstep in a basket. That was one way you dealt with babies you couldn't keep back then before modern adoption agencies. And so, well, we're clearly well before modern adoption agencies in Sargon's time and in Moses's time. So maybe this was just a custom that they used back then, in which case there's no reason to doubt its historicity. But let's suppose that you do. Let's suppose the story of the Exodus as we have it in Scripture does incorporate some elements that, you know, are inspired by Akhenaten or by Sargon. I'm not saying that's the case, but I'm just granting this for purposes of argument to the skeptic. How does that challenge the idea that the Exodus occurred? Even if you doubt some details of the story, that doesn't mean the core of the story is wrong. People can get details of historical events wrong, like, you know, eyewitnesses, let's say, of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Some people think John Wilkes Booth shouted "Sic Semper Tyrannis" when he landed on the stage. Other people thought he shouted something else. But that doesn't change the core of the story that Abraham Lincoln got shot and then died.
Right.
And in the same way, particular details of the Exodus account don't, even if you reject a particular detail, that doesn't disprove the whole thing. And we actually do have good evidence for the Exodus as a as an event in general.
Okay, so that brings us to our very last objection from Lawton. Objection to that Lawton is not making these. He read these and he wants Jimmy to respond to them. They are objections to the biblical account of the Exodus. The last one is, there are no records of a mass exodus.
So there are a couple of things we need to talk about here. The first one is what's meant by a mass exodus. Now, the Hebrew text, this is in the book of Numbers, it talks about the number of Israelites who came out of Egypt. In fact, that's the reason the book of Numbers is called Numbers, because at the beginning and the end of the book, they take a census, a military census, and identify how many men are there that are 20 or older that could fight on behalf of Israel. And so you've got this beginning numbering and this ending numbering. And the numbers are slightly different, but because they occur at different points in time. But basically, they say that there were 600 Alapim. And the question is, plus change, there are 600 Alapim of Israelite men 20 and over. And the question is, what is an Alapim? Well, the term has more than one meaning. One of its meanings is 1,000. So this would, if that's the meaning that's correct, it would be 600,000 Israelite men. And you'd need to multiply that by, say, 3 or maybe 4 to get the total number of Israelites, including women and children and so forth.
A huge
and
number
that would,
of people.
Yeah, that's going on 2 million.
Yeah.
And the entire population of Egypt at this time was thought to be 3 million.
Yeah.
So if the interpretation 1,000 is right, wow, that's really not that's really significant, and it's not very plausible that that's the size.
Right.
But alapim has more than one meaning. Alapim can also mean fighting units or clans or platoons or things like that. And even skeptical scholars today, you know, people who don't really take the biblical text seriously, acknowledge that, yeah, okay, alapim means these other things. So the Exodus account in Numbers, or the censuses in Numbers, may only be indicating they had 600 platoons.
Yeah.
Or something like that. In which case, there may have just been a few thousand Israelites coming out. Now, so that deals with kind of the mass Exodus part. It may not have been anywhere near as massive as you might think. But what about records? Well, okay, would we even expect there to be an Egyptian record of this? And the answer is no, because the Egyptians didn't – I mean, there may have been one like in a day book somewhere written on papyrus that then disintegrated. And that would have especially happened because of where they were leaving from. They were leaving from the Delta region of the Nile, which is very wet. And as a result, we have very little writing from the Delta region. When they find scrolls and stuff, it's way south of there where it's much more dry.
Yeah.
So other than being written on like a day book or a letter or something on a scroll, where else would we find it? Well, we could find it written on a monument. But the thing about monuments are, the Egyptians don't record defeats on them, because the purpose of a monument is to enshrine your successes. And in particular, on their religious monuments, it's to thank the gods for giving you these successes. And so they don't record their defeats. They only record it when they win. Right. And sometimes we can tell that they're actually losing because they keep winning battles, but the battles are getting closer and closer to home. So you can tell they're actually retreating.
Yeah.
Well, if you have a situation like the Exodus where you lose control of a bunch of your slaves and they head out.
Right.
That's not something you're going to be thanking the gods for on your monuments. So we wouldn't expect to find a record of it on Egyptian monuments. However, we do find that on the Merneptah stela, a record of a victory that Merneptah had in battle with the Israelites later on when they were still apparently an unsettled people.
Yeah.
So that is an Egyptian record of something that looks like the Exodus. And then there's the fact, the Old Testament itself is a record.
Yeah.
Why are you dismissing the Old Testament as containing information of historical value? You can't just do that. This is not a guilty until proven innocent thing. If you're going to be fair and objective about ancient documents, be fair and objective about ancient documents. Even if you're not religious, you need to say with any given document of the ancient period, okay, what in this is likely historically reliable? And the idea that we used to be a bunch of slaves and then we got away because our God helped us out, that's historically credible. Because if you're making up an origin story for your people, you're not going to say, we used to be a bunch of insignificant slaves until we escaped. That's a humiliating national epic, not a glorious national epic. And so treating this as you would any other historical document, we've got evidence for the Exodus.
That was so fascinating. I am so glad, Lawton, that you asked about that. We have to take a quick break, and this will be the perfect time to do that. It's Internet Open Forum today. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we're answering the Internet's questions. We will get back to that as soon as we are done with this break. But before we go to the break, David's here, David Matheson, Director of Development here, and I know why you're here. When you come, it's Society 315.
It is indeed, Sai. We are once again promoting Society 315. Society 315, it's of course, for those who are not familiar with it, it is our new online monthly donors club. For $10 or more per month, you become a member of Society 315, and the whole premise behind the club is to help you become a better defender of the faith. And then from our perspective, we really want to be as connected as possible to our supporters, to those who want to be a part of our mission. And the society is built around that as well. So when you join the club, you get a society t-shirt. In fact,
I have one. I got one.
Here's the t-shirt right here. Cy Kellett is a member. He has
really,
a t-shirt.
It's a freakishly good t-shirt, too. It's like also, did you guys know you were getting this? It's so soft, and everybody's like...
You know, we work with a small Catholic fulfillment company here in San Diego, and they said, we're going to get you a great shirt, and we trusted them.
Boy, they did.
And here it is.
Yeah.
Yep, sure enough. So in addition to the shirt, you'll get a Catholic.com car magnet, and what a lot of folks like is the perpetual 20% discount on Catholic Answers product on our shop. It never expires. So as long as you're a member, you can use this code and get 20% off of everything Catholic Answers produces in the shop. There's also ongoing members-only content, which is one more reason why we wanted to make sure to promote the club today. I know Erica mentioned last week that Father David McConey, who a lot of you are familiar with, he's been on the show several times. Yeah. He was at our conference 2 years ago. Wonderful professor at St. Louis University. He did a one-day retreat for the Catholic Answers staff last Wednesday. It was fabulous. And for members only, we are providing the video of that. We're going to send you a link. But to get that, we're going to be sending it out here in the next couple of days. You need to join today. If you want to get that, go get that retreat, go on retreat with us. It's a condensed version of St. Ignatius's spiritual exercises. Again, it was wonderful. You were there, Cy. We all benefited from it. We
it
want
great.
You to benefit as well.
CASociety315.com is where you can go. If you're already a donor, you just join. But you got to you send us an email, right, and say, I want to be a member.
Correct. If you are already a monthly donor of $10 plus, email society315@catholic.com and just say, hey, I'm already a donor. We'll pull you up and tell us that you want to add society benefits to your existing monthly donation.
Society 315, it's the new club here at Catholic Answers. We're trying to build a whole community of people who are ready to explain and defend their faith. CASociety315.com or give us the email address again.
Society315@catholic.com.
Thanks, David.
Thank you, Cy.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an internet open forum. All of our questions today from the internet. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, ready to answer each of these questions. And the next question comes from Asanga. And the question is as follows. In Theravada Buddhism, they say that vanishing both the body, death to dust, and especially the soul, spirit of Atman, is the ultimate deliverance. So you attain nirvana. That is by total deliverance of karma, just like the Buddha did. This is not the Mahayana concept. All other religions and philosophies are primitive, as they think that the Atman is eternal, that the Lord Buddha removed all like disappearing flame. Is Christianity and other religions which have eternal life primitive in that sense? Thanks.
Okay, so Asanga is referring to a couple of different schools of thought in Buddhism that people may not be familiar with. Theravada Buddhism is the original form. And it's not the most common form of Buddhism today. Most Buddhists are Mahayana, and there's another one that's connected with Tibetan Buddhism. And they're actually more common than the historically original form. But the original Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, held that in order to experience true liberation from suffering, you needed to get rid of all desire. And you could do that by using certain principles that he referred to as the Eightfold Path. And this was the goal of his spiritual striving. He didn't care about gods and whether any gods exist. He was agnostic on that question. His chief idea was that as long as we're trapped in this world, in the cycle of reincarnation, we're going to suffer. And so the how you get liberated from that is you stop the cycle of reincarnation by stopping the karma that drives you forward into new incarnations where you'll suffer more. And when you're able to do that, when you're able to extinguish all of your karma, you then attain nirvana, which is compared to the blowing out of a flame. And this applies not just to your body, but to your soul or life principle or true self, which is what's known as the Atman. And so there, now this will be looked at a little bit differently by different kinds of Buddhists, but some Buddhists, including in the Theravada tradition, will look at this and say, you as an individual really don't survive long term. You may survive this life, but you don't survive as a single conscious individual once you hit nirvana and you have the blowing out of all desire. And so even the life principle or soul is not held to be eternal on this view. And so how would we then evaluate the claim that some, coming from a Theravada perspective, might make about other religions that do believe in an immortal soul by saying they're primitive? Well, primitive is it's basically an insult word. You can call anyone you want from a religious perspective primitive. You can say any given idea you want is primitive.
Right.
So you can look at people in the West might look at Theravada Buddhism and say, oh, this stuff about the Eightfold Path and reincarnation and stuff, oh, all that's primitive. You know, this is not the highly refined, you know, belief system that we have here in the West, where we have elaborate arguments for monotheism and the existence of God and, right, and the existence of the eternal soul and stuff. This is all primitive speculation. And so really, primitive is just a silly putty word that anybody can apply to virtually anybody else. Even if they're wrapping themselves in modern stuff like technology, you can always find a way to portray someone you don't like as secretly primitive. Yeah. And so I would say that rather than debating whether an idea is primitive or not is not very helpful, because sometimes it's the primitive stuff that's right. And, you know, just because something is old doesn't mean it's wrong. And just because something is traditional doesn't mean it's wrong. So there are older traditional ideas that, in fact, are more correct than some of the ideas that get entertained later on. So the date at which an idea occurs is not a reliable indicator of its accuracy. What you really want to look at is not whether someone considers an idea primitive or whether an idea is older or newer. It's what's the evidence for the idea? That's the real test. Do we have good evidence for this idea or not? And I would say, as a Christian apologist, we've got really good evidence for the Christian faith. And I prefer not to get into, are other people's ideas primitive? Because that simply is a term that will add more heat than light. I'd rather talk about the evidence.
Asanga, thank you so much for the question. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and it's an internet open forum. All of our questions have come to us one way or another in written form over the internet. We're going to continue that next hour. One of the great advantages of the Internet Open Forum is we tend to get a good collection before we you know, because we save them up over a period of weeks and even months sometimes. A good collection of really interesting questions. I think you will agree that this first hour has shown that. Lots of fascinating questions. Second hour, more fascinating questions coming, and I'm very interested to hear what Jimmy has to say about them. So hang out with us. We are going to continue with Internet Open Forum right here on Catholic Answers Live.